Well, I could never find my way in playing a modern style, modern bebop. I tried for many years to play bebop, you know, like Dizzy Gillespie or Miles Davis. But then I gave up because I realized I couldn't play like them, exactly like them. And then one day somebody played me a CD of Booker Little, and I realized that you could go a different direction, but still be considered a jazz player. So yeah, that's when I started to try and feel out a different way. And I didn't want to play like him, but I wanted to find another way. So I think it came a bit of a shock to the local jazz players when I switched over and started to play in the free music.
Improv pod. At the top of this recording, you heard a typically self-deprecating excerpt from the subject of this podcast, the trumpeter, cornetist, flugelhorn player, band leader, composer and improviser Kenny Wheeler. This podcast is my humble tribute to a musician recognised throughout the jazz community globally as one of its greats, and one who we sadly lost last September at the age of 84. Kenny Wheeler was born in Toronto, but raised in North Ontario, in Windsor and then in St Catharines on the other side of Lake Ontario, due south of Toronto, from his mid-teenage years. I had the privilege to interview Kenny Wheeler twice, and the excerpts you can hear in this recording were made in June 2012 in Kenny's Leytonstone home, which now bears a blue plaque in his honour. At the time of this interview, Kenny was not in the greatest of health, and throughout his life displayed a reticence to talk about his own music. So what is included here is a short edit, but one I hope displays the warmth of a man revered by so many and whose music remains a touchstone for absolute quality. 26 years earlier, when I was working for Time Out, I'd been in that same modest house and received the same warm welcome. It was a family home, typical of its kind and a delight to be in. Kenny and Doreen Wheeler had stayed in that house since 1973 and raised a family there. It was also the working space of a composer, and the front room of the house was largely given over to Kenny's music and his composition processes. In a corner, between the chimney breast and the bay window, there was a small upright piano on which Kenny would compose, sounding out chords and melodies, and Kenny was a far better piano player than he'd ever admit to. Between that piano and the door was Kenny's large music stand, which was nothing but a huge flat wooden board, and here and there trumpet paraphernalia and odd sheets of scores lay about. It was all kind of shoehorned in, but it was clearly a space that Kenny felt very comfortable in. Back in the 1980s, in that same front room, Kenny had told me how, as a lad growing up and learning his instrument, he had already developed the characteristic shyness and introspection that followed him onto every stage he subsequently played on, and how he would row a small boat out onto Lake Ontario, or maybe it was a smaller body of water somewhere in the Niagara system, taking his cornet with him so that he could practice without fear of being overheard. Wheeler had extensive academic music training as a child, but quit a music degree in Montreal after 1 year and moved to England at the age of 22. In the UK, at first he struggled to find his feet with British jazz bands, but eventually became a part of John Dankworth's big band and worked with Tubby Hayes, Ronnie Scott and Joe Harrier, whilst retaining study and interest in formal composed modern music, and he's expressed some influence from composers such as Paul Hindemith. In the mid-1960s, he met pianist John Taylor and bass player Dave Holland, who were practicing at Ronnie Scott's old place, the original club, and both of whom became long-term musical partners of Kenny's, working together in some fine bands and making some amazing recordings on the way. Wheeler's subtle, tuneful, but complex writing for big band settings increasingly caught John Dankworth's eye, and in 1968, Dankworth released an album of Wheeler big band compositions, The Sweet Windmill Tilter, The Story of Don Quixote. Modesty fed into his music throughout his life, and I can't ever recall anything he played being brash, overstated or showy for the sake of it. He was, however one might choose to define the phrase, a virtuoso performer with an instantly recognisable tone and harmonic palette. His solos were hallmarked by vertiginous but always logically and deeply expressive leaps between the octaves, and with a sense of melody and harmony that was complex but highly effective, belonging in some part to an earlier romantic musical tradition, and was for the most part highly original. It is difficult to think of any musician who has spanned the various styles of jazz with such consistency, being equally at home in fully composed time sessions as he was in free improvisation. But as he stated at the beginning of this recording, Kenny Wheeler wanted to find another way, and free improvisation, which in London at that time was in a very dynamic and increasingly multicultural phase, became a part of his playing. Kenny was, as he states, an early recruit to London's legendary Little Theatre Club scene, where he worked with drummer and organiser John Stevens, and in early versions of Stevens' Spontaneous Music Ensemble, and across Europe with the likes of Alexander von Schlippenbach's Globe Unity Orchestra. In February 1968, as part of the Spontaneous Music Ensemble, with Stevens, Evan Park on saxophones, Derek Bailey on guitar, and Dave Holland on bass, Wheeler recorded Carry Obin, the first landmark recording of free improvisation in the UK, and which, characteristically, he underplays in this interview.
I was doing a lot of free playing around Europe,
yeah,
with the Globe Unity and bands like that.
Yeah.
Back in London, I had a rare jazz gig. I didn't get many gigs at all, probably because of the way I played, I don't know. But I think back in London I was working with John Taylor and people like that.
When did that sort of, how did that become working with John Stevens? Because that's a sort of another step further, you know.
I don't remember how I started first working with him. I must have done a couple of gigs with him or something when he was a more conventional player. And he liked what I did, so he then asked me to do, if I wanted to play on some free records, you know.
Yeah.
Was getting frustrated because I wasn't getting many jazz gigs. And then I heard about this theater club where they were playing this new kind of music. So I went along and listened a couple of nights and I didn't like it. But then about the third night, they asked me if I wanted to sit in. So I sat in and I think I went berserk on the trumpet when I sat in. And that impressed them, I think. It was like getting a lot out of my system, I think. Trevor Watts and Derek Bailey was in there as well, and yeah. Evan, of course, and Paul Rutherford, I think, was part of that scene.
Yeah, yeah. As somebody who came from a kind of a jazz tradition as a player, how did you kind of, did you see that as a sort of a, as an extension of the jazz world, was it an extension of what you were already playing, or did you see it as something sort of from the outside, as it were?
Well, I always thought I was part of the jazz world, yeah. Even though my playing might have got a bit strange sometimes, but I guess it was quite a milestone record, wasn't it? But it wasn't anything to do with the Beatles, that kind of music.
No.
Kenny's explorations of jazz and free improv continued, and he toured Europe with large-scale bands that included US luminaries such as saxophonist Steve Lacy. In early 1973, he straddled both worlds again with the composition recording of the LP A Song for Someone, that went on to become the Melody Makers album of the year. The record features a blend of styles from big band melodies and arrangements to duet-free improvisations.
Well, London was very... There was a lot happening in London at that time, you know, like...
Yeah.
Mike Gibbs and Mike Westbrook and... And the Brotherhood of Breath were happening.
Yeah.
It was great to be around that time, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But do you think you ever kind of left the free play? How... Was it just the demands on your time with other music, or... Did you feel as though you moved away yourself from the free?
No, I never felt that I'd moved away from it, but I guess I tried to incorporate some ideas of it into my own playing, I guess. Yeah, Steve Lacy was also happening at that time. He was quite prominent in the free world.
Yeah.
I can't remember when I met him. I did know him quite early on, I think, yeah. I had a tour over here with a big band once with... I think it was with four trombones and a front line of six people, which was Norma, Steve Lason, me, and Evan, I think. And
oh, right, yeah.
I asked Steve Lason to do it. He seemed happy to do it, so... I remember about that tour, though, that I thought that Steve Lason didn't have enough solos to play, so I think I asked him one night if he wanted to play a completely solo piece by himself.
Yeah.
And he just said, well, all right, oh, but you're... It's like asking the moon for a solo. So he played one solo piece.
Yeah.
Completely solo then.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's on the record or not, but I don't think there is a record of that tour, is there? It was an unusual lineup. There was four trombones and a front line of six. And I think Derek Bailey was on it. And maybe also John Taylor, I think. But it was strange with Derek Bailey because he wouldn't... Although he came up in the dance band world and he could read music, he had taken a decision not to play any written music.
Yeah.
So I just had to say to him, well, just do whatever you want. When you hear something, just do it. So, because that was about time, around the time of Song for Someone. And I liked what he did on that record. It was... Very interesting, I think. Although with Derek, I never actually realized, or never felt that he actually liked what I did. I think he always felt like I was a bit of an intruder into the free world, I think. I liked him very much, though, but...
Yeah.
I know he fell out with Evan in later years, which was a shame. Yeah. He could do all that normal stuff, I think, but he definitely left behind... Because I had been writing for big band for a few years at that time, and
yeah,
nice to get an opportunity to to have the things played in for somebody, you know, so.
Yeah.
And there was quite a few problems making that record Song for Someone, because both because my rhythmic sense was a little bit strange for, because I used a lot of the normal jazz musicians on Song for Someone.
Yeah.
And they couldn't quite understand what I was trying to do, I don't think. Especially Tony Oakley's drumming, kind of. Some of them didn't really like that, the way he was playing, but I still think it's a really good record.
Wheeler's introspective melodic style was gaining prominence, and in 1975 his first recording for ECM, New High, was released with Keith Jarrett on piano, Jack DeJohnette on drums and Dave Holland on bass. Soon after, another recording featuring Jan Gabarek on saxophone, Dear One, followed on ECM, and then recordings with John Taylor and Norman Winstone of his Azimuth grouping, and other recordings with Ralph Towner. Here he considers how the link with ECM came about, and the extraordinary performance of Keith Jarrett on New High.
I think it did start around that time, around, that was about 1975, wasn't it, or something? Because Manfred Eicher must have, he was slightly involved in freer music.
Yeah.
And I think people like Evan and the others must have mentioned that I was a trumpet player he should look at, so he then gave me a CD of my own. Yeah, he played fantastic on that record, I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think that happened very quickly, didn't it? Did he just... You guys just sort of met there and then and made it and that was it? You were, you know...
That was about it, yeah.
Yeah.
Although I think I had a rehearsal with Dave and Jack DeJohnette a couple of days before the record.
Yeah.
Because Dave knew my music anyway.
Yeah.
And Jack was very easy to pick up on what I wanted. So he had a look at the music, but I don't think he actually knew it.
Thank you.
Kenny would occasionally pop up as a player in some unusual places also, including recording some album tracks with ex-Japan singer David Sylvian, who Kenny found to be, quote, a very intense young man. He once said in an interview with the BBC that, "I write sad songs, and then I get the musicians to destroy them." But it was not only sad songs he kept composing, and compelling big band scores. He kept close to the free improv world. This podcast closes then with an excerpt from Foxy's Fox, a recording Kenny made in February 2007 at the Vortex London, with Evan Parker on saxophone, Steve Beresford piano, John Edwards double bass, and Lewis Maholo Maholo on percussion for the Psy M&M label. My thanks to ECM and Psy M&M for permission to use these tracks. Full track listings are available on my website, peterurpeth.wordpress.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell everyone you can. And please follow this podcast series on Podomatic. Thank you.
I still try to write a bit every day, but it gets harder as you get older to write, to think of anything different. It feels like everything that's been written has been done. It's been written.
Yeah.